Accession number 30078, Reel 5.
Patrick Emerson, Reel 5. Yeah, just before we continue with Japan, did you vote in the 1945 elections?
No. I don't think I was even asked to. Possibly because I was being so mobile at the time. I don't think I was. I just heard they were on. I was amazed when Churchill went, but then you thought automatically he would go on, I think. And it was so far away.
And what was your response to the end of the war with Japan?
Oh, I think I was pleased. You know, there had been so much killing, and an awful lot of people I knew had been killed. And then you'd heard stories of the captives in Japan and this sort of thing. Well, not in Japan, captives in Japanese prison camps. I think one obviously was pleased. War is not a nice thing. I mean, if you find people who brag about war, they're usually people who didn't see very much in that. War itself is no joke at all. It's bloody awful. I mean, I've listened to so many people who've been truthful about it, who didn't want to talk about it. They said, no, it's a memory I'd rather forget. So I'm rather glad I never got stuck into it. I'm sure I'd died of fright. I'd seen one enemy and gone... any other question?
Well, did you have any particular attitude towards the Japanese?
No, apart from the indoctrinated attitude of they were small, brutal, and what's the word I want? Somebody who will do anything, even through to his death. You know, single. That's all I really knew about them. I knew nothing before. I'd heard of the Japanese before, obviously, because they were on our side in the First World War, so history had learned that. I knew very little about them, indeed. I was sent on a course when I first joined the military, when I was in Lucknow, I was sent on a 2 weeks course up near Simla. They used to classify prisoners who came, Japanese prisoners and Indians who'd fought the Japanese, as white, brown and black. White was, they're not harmful. They just did it out of necessity or anything, or they were just ordinary soldiers. Brown was... bit dicey, you know, why did they do it? Watch them. Black was they were hardened Japanese warfare or people who hardened in INA men and people like that. I went on that course, quite honestly, one didn't learn an awful lot about Japanese on it. In fact, it was a hard drinking course. By that time, I did drink. That's about all I ever, the closest I came to Japanese, really. So for me, landing in Japan was a really brand new experience, and especially in the heartland of the enemy, whom I'd heard so many bad things about. You didn't quite land with your heart in your mouth, but you landed full of sort of, oh, what's happening, what's it all about? So we landed in Iwakuni, which was the RAF and RAAF, the Australian Air Force, as well, their main base, so you were completely surrounded by Europeans, Australians and that. And the next day I was told that the Brindiv headquarters was near Kure, just outside Kure. Oh, let me just, can you switch off for a second? Let's just see.
The writing in Japan.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So we had one night at Iwakuni, and then I was told to go up to Kure, where the first part of the British Indian Division had already landed. They didn't quite know where they were going to go. One of the problems was that the Americans didn't want anybody except themselves occupying Japan, and there was a lot of argument between the Australian, British and American government, the Australians especially, saying, look, we did a lot of work in the Pacific, we will occupy part of it. And in the end, it was agreed at a high level that we could do it. And then the Americans on the ground thought, quite sensibly in a way, well, we dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. it'd be better if the British and the Americans that occupied that area, at least they can't be blamed for dropping the bomb, and the Americans moved away. So we had pretty well the southern six prefectures in Honshu and the whole of Shikoku Island, which was quite a large area, really. And so we had to work out what to do, and I then had to work out my military police things, but I couldn't do that until I knew what. So we went to Kure while people were forming up, and I went into a great big large barrack block that I think had been Japanese troops. I had a little room in the corner of my own while all the rest of the troops were in the same block, and I had in their mess and everything. On the outside of the block were great big black painted circles, and this greatly intrigued me, and finally I was told that they were the sign of where the comfort girls used to live and be visited by the troops. We were actually in an ex-brothel, which was probably a suitable thing entirely for me anyhow. It was then decided very quickly that the British element would occupy all of Shikoku Island, that the Indians would occupy Okayama and the two provinces north of it. The Australians would occupy all the rest down to Kure, and the New Zealanders would occupy the very last prefecture. I should remember all the names, I can't. So then we started to move up. I moved up to Okayama, and slowly the other troops came up and took over their places, and I had to send out military police to their areas as well. Now, the Indians had battalion groups and three battalion groups. Well, each battalion had its own regimental police, so really they didn't need any more. So what I had was in the main towns, in Tottori, Yamage, and up there I had just a small detachment of Indian military police. In Okayama I kept most of them because that was the headquarters, and I had British military police because they all came under my one group in Shikoku Island, and there were only two stations there in which the British troops were stationed, so I had the police in between, but they could move around the island where they wanted. I think one of our greatest difficulties in the occupation was that the Americans, in their usual way, had been very friendly with everybody when they landed. They talked to the Japanese, talked to anybody. The British, in their rather slightly snooty manner, immediately issued a no fraternization order. Nobody was to talk to the Japanese, which personally I think was silly, because it cut us off, and the Japanese themselves said, well, what's wrong with these people? They don't even talk to us, whereas the Americans have been friendly and nattered away and so on. It also meant, of course, that if a man wanted a girl or anything like that, it was pretty well underground. He had to grab and hide and disappear with one. And the PD rate shot up tremendously. There was a big conference at which I had to be present. This is terrible. What are we doing about it? So I said, well, look, I'm patrolling everywhere I can. And I said, it's very easy for a man to meet a woman and go behind a burnt-out building and that, and I wouldn't know. And because it's behind a burnt-out building, there's no hygiene or anything at all, so these things are going to happen. So we've got the British attitude again of, no, no, increase the patrols, rush around more. We did. It didn't make any difference. General Cowan was commanding then. He was the division. He was pretty good. The present Viscount Slim was actually his captain ADC. But we did have one or two old-fashioned officers who sort of said, no, men don't need women, you must stop them doing it, and so on. Luckily, there were some others who were a bit more down-to-earth and said, it's bound to happen occasionally. Do what you can to try and keep the numbers down. So, in cahoots with the medical service and the Japanese police, because I also had a control over something like 13,000 Japanese police. Now, they weren't if you like, literally under my control, AMGOT, that's the Allied Military Government, who are all American. They control the civil side of things, but there were only a small number of them, so they told me, you look after the Japanese police. And I used to have about four Japanese police chiefs, which I could call in on them any time and ask what's happening, but they carried on with their normal police duties. But they were very, very helpful. And
had they previously been police? Had they previously been police?
Oh, they were the civilian police. Yeah, they were the proper civilian police. They just had to change their ways from what they used to be of interrogating, stopping, arresting them, into being what we considered police, and that's doing your normal police duties. And they actually, they switched over very, very well. I think they were relieved at not being, as has happened in Iraq, completely disbanded and thrown out, and that they were kept as proper units. And in fact, I became very, very friendly with the chiefs. We had two big stations in Okayama, Nishisho and Higekisho, I think, and they ran half the town each. And there'd be another one up north, another one in Yamaguchi. And then in the South Island, there was one, the South Island is in four prefectures. There was one main unit for each prefecture. So I was in contact with something like eight Japanese police chiefs. Again, it wasn't up to me to tell them exactly what to do. That was up to the AMGOT, the Americans, but the Americans would say to me, well, make sure they do their normal job, that's the main thing. Occasionally, there would be the odd thing when, was rather embarrassing, all Japanese war criminals were to be arrested. Now, we received information through AMGOT that there was a Japanese colonel wanted for war crimes living up near near Okutsu, and that I should apprehend him. Well, I didn't quite know what to do. I thought, if I take my own military police up, we don't know the area, we'll be seen, they could make a warning. So I got hold of the chief of police, Japanese, and I said, I know this is embarrassing for you, but look, we've got to do this, it must be done. I want to your men and my men to work together. And they were very good, they did. And we went up there and we did the usual police thing of dawn, surround the house, knock on the door, went in, and there was a horrible scene. He'd committed harakiri. He'd heard we were coming, and he sat there and he'd literally cut himself. But as you know, you're meant to cut across and up, but he just got across and then down he went. But the place was blood everywhere. And wife sobbing her heart out, and children, grown-up children crying. It affected me very strongly, that scene, and I think it affected the chief of police too, although he was used to these sort of things. It was a horrible thing. Luckily, that was just our one case only. We didn't have any more, but I know that in the other prefectures they had some. Otherwise, it was normal police work for them and just keeping contact with them, and normal military police work for me, trying to keep the troops under control. In the end, I took a lot of things into my own hands, in that as regards VD, there were a number of brothels. I got the police to introduce me to all the mama sons in each brothel, and I had a meeting with them and said, look, we will not raid you without warning you, but on the other hand, if there's any, when I warn you, then if there are any drunks or difficult people or people refuse to go, leave them. We'll arrest them when we come in. But I said, for God's sake, keep it as clean as you can, and your girls must attend a weekly inspection at the Japanese hospital, but it will be done by the British military doctors. And so it did bring the number down a bit. I mean, not a lot, but it did bring it down a bit. Now, this was all illegal, and we were always worried sick that the British press would get on it and say, oh, Japanese, you know, women being groomed for our boys, or look what our boys have been given. And so General Kahn said, you've got to be very, very careful doing this, and we did it very, very carefully. People did get to know that the Friday was the day when the girls were inspected, and outside the hospital you would find quite a long line of Allied vehicles waiting for the clean ones, at which my vehicle was usually at the head. Unfortunately. But there we are. I enjoyed it. I made some very fine friends. We had trouble with troops getting drunk and running mad. But our name was really made for us by an event that happened in the New Zealand area, where a Japanese killed a New Zealand soldier who had burst into his home and wanted to rape his wife and everything. And a Japanese man, in fighting him, had killed him. And of course, the word got around quickly in the Japanese papers, and it was all, oh, I suppose he'll be let off and that. And he wasn't. He was court-martialed, convicted of murder, found guilty, and sent back to New Zealand prison. And the Japanese were very affected by that. They said, oh, look, they even deal with their own people properly, and the case was well handled, and from a propaganda view, it was very, very good for us. And we tried to tell them, we'll handle you in normal police ways, we'll make no exceptions for our people because they happen to be on the winning side. Because nobody could tick me off, as I was the chief ticker off, I took every possible advantage I could. I had a bloody wonderful time. I went where I wanted. I knew all the brothels and the girls. I was invited to quite a number of the religious ceremonies and sat up with the priests and watched it all happening, you know, at the very heart of it all. And about once every 2 or 3 months, the Japanese police would invite me out for, they would say, a dinner, which sometimes ended in a whole night with a lady provided. The one that sticks in my mind is they took myself and my second-in-command up to a hill. I don't know if it was a resort, a hill village anyhow, which was famous for its hot pools. And we had the usual dinner and got thoroughly sloshed on sake. We were all dressed in yukata, you know, the lightweight kimono. And it was bitterly cold outside. And the police said, we'll go up towards a hot pools. So up we staggered through the village late at night and got to these hot pools and stripped off and got in. And then, to my amazement, the policeman said, and we will now continue the drinking, and put his hand into a cold pool nearby and pulled out a bottle of beer. And they'd stacked these things with drink. It didn't end till very, very early in the morning when we came walking back like this through the village. And how I wasn't killed, I don't know. There were the remnants of a bridge that had been bombed and blown up. There was just about one girder going across this deep ravine, and I insisted on walking across it. It was no wider than that. I mean, I'm bloody stupid. But I got across and got back. I think people thought I'd had it. But that's my one special part, you remember. But I had a wonderful time. As I say, I broke all the rules. It's not good military outlook. But we kept what I like to think is a good, amicable peace between us and the Japanese. We tried to deal fairly with both sides. One thing that was unusual, I was asked by the Japanese police twice to help them in policing Korean rallies, because a lot of Koreans lived in Japan. And they got the idea that we're on the winning side, we can do what we like. And although they'd lived in Japan for a generation or two. And they held a couple of rallies in which they got a bit obstreperous and that. And so the Japanese police asked if I would help, and I ran down a couple of vehicles with, actually one had a machine gun mounted on it. And they began to wonder whether something would happen, and it worked out all right. And the other thing was, when they celebrated their main day, they congregated at some large stadium, had all sorts of speeches and that, and then, to my utter amazement, they burst into, when old acquaintance be forgot. And apparently, what is it, you know, the song, Korean song, about the boy who studies by the light of the... Yes, Hotaru. Hotaru na?
Excuse me.
Hotaru no hikari. And they burst, and that apparently then was the Japanese national anthem to that tune.
No, Korean.
Korean national anthem. And we were utterly amazed to hear them sing what we thought was your old acquaintance be forgot. But on the whole, we didn't have much trouble. There you are, I get the full service. Do you want to switch off? I had a very good interpreter attached to me, Kama-san. He was a Japanese who'd lived in America for over 30 years. He was about 70-something. And he had gone back to Japan to visit his relatives at the outbreak of the war, just before it started. The war broke out and he couldn't go back to America. And so he was too old to be called up or anything, but he, because he could speak good American, because he spoke real American, you know, hi there, how you doing, and this sort of stuff, he was attached to us as an interpreter, and he had some very wonderful ideas, and he's most amusing, but one very good thing was, I used to have on the front of my Jeep, APM, Brindiv, Assistant Provost Marshal Brindiv. He said, no, he said, take that off, put Kempitaicho Brindiv on it. So I said, why? He said, oh, just sit, you do it. So we printed in Kempitaicho British. First time went out to a village, everybody rushed out, including the headman. Ha ha! Kempitaicho! And I was treated just as the Kempitai had been treated. And from then on, it worked wonders. I had all sorts of meals in villages and things, purely on the grounds of what was written on the front was Kempitaicho.
What did that mean?
It means the head of the Kempitai, who, you know, were the feared police. They were the really nasty Japanese police. And Taicho is just head. So head of the Kempitai. And of course, Kama-san used to make the most of it. Oh, yes, he's very senior British officer. I had everybody out, the villagers and the lot. And he had all sorts of brainy ideas like that. But on the whole, things went well. And then the British were getting worried because they had all the rumours of people back home were getting jobs and it was going to be difficult to get jobs, and many of them were due for demob and they'd been held up a bit to be in Brindiv. And also in India, it was obvious that independence was coming and Mountbatten was sent out with the avowed intention of giving them independence, and as you know, he brought it a year forward, should have been 48, he brought it 47. So the Indian troops also were getting a bit worried because they were hearing of murders and killing and pillage and that going on in India, and many of them came from the areas where all this was happening. So it was decided to withdraw Brindiv, and they started pulling back, I think half the British unit went first. It was obviously that my job was going to come down, but I had no desire to come back to India. I was enjoying Japan greatly. And so I said, I'm happy to stay out here, and I come down to captain again. I was major, and I come down to captain again, which is my, by that time, my substantive rank, because I just had 8 years' service in. Doesn't worry me. So they sent me off to command a rest camp in north of Shikoku, which had been an old Japanese seaplane base. I was the only officer there, and I wore mufti. Well, it was a kind of mufti. I didn't wear uniform. There were three Wakais there, all fairly aged, but very good. And not Wakai, WVS. We didn't have any Wakais. And I think I had about the usual staff of a sergeant major, quartermaster sergeant there, but most of them wore mufti. And the camp took Australians, New Zealand, British and Indian, which of course resulted occasionally in interracial arguments, the Indians getting a bit stroppy or the Aussies getting stroppy, and of course drinking. The Australians, New Zealands were there, but the idea was it was leave, let them have it. And I enjoyed that until I did a very silly thing. One day there was an Indian soldier standing there and really slang to Australians in Urdu. So I was the only one who could understand. They didn't know what he was saying, but he was really going to town, you know, you bastard, and this and all the bad things you could think of. And he said, we're free now, anyhow, we're going to be free, we don't worry about you people. And I yelled at him in Urdu, shut up. And he turned around to me, and I said, mufti, and he said, shut up, back again. I said, don't you talk to me like that, you shut up, because you're being bloody rude to these men. And he answered me back, and stupidly I hit him. Well, okay, so I hit him. Anyhow, that night, going round the mess halls where they were all eating, as I came in, he was sitting at a table in front, and I saw him look up, and I thought, oh dear, I hate that look. Not long after, I got summoned down to headquarters to go before the general, having struck a soldier. And he said, this is a court-martial offence. I said, well, I did. I plead guilty. I struck him. I said, I'll tell you why I struck him. And I explained the whole situation to him. So then and there, I had, I forget what they call it in India, one senior officer can be a whole court-martial board on his own. So he was an Indian. He gave me a severe reprimand and said, you'll go back to India. So that was the end of my career there. Luckily, the documents in Japan and the documents in India never arrive with each other, and so it never appeared on my record. And I waited a bit and then came back to India on a troop ship, stopping at Hong Kong and Singapore, arrived at Madras, and the RTO, the railway transport officer, said to me, where are you going? I don't know, where are you going to send me? He said, well, what have you opted for? I said, what do you mean, what have I opted for? He said, well, all regular officers were told to opt for British Army if they could be fitted in their rank and in their training service, or pension if they were available, you know, serve long enough for pension, or to offer to serve with the Indian or Pakistan forces. I said, well, I never received that paper. What had happened was I was away on my own in the island, I was forgotten. So he said, well, we better send you back to your regimental centre and refer the case up to Army headquarters. So I went back to Nasirabad, and there I hung around as a spare captain, sent out twice to quell riots in Ajmer. One rather worried me, and the Hindus were attacking a very, very holy Mohammedan shrine in Ajmer, and I was sent out with a Hindu company, which I thought, oh dear, I'm worried about this, but luckily the Jemadar and Subedar were very good, and they made sure that it was all under control. But it was a little worrying, with all Hindus on my side against a Hindu mob. That all worked out, and then, to my utter surprise, I got a posting to Pakistan to command the 3rd Battalion, 14th Punjab Regiment, as acting Lieutenant Colonel. I've never yet to this day understood why I was chosen, because if you looked at my record, I had no fighting experience at all. All my experience had been in specialized things like adjutant, boys' company, military police, and so on. I think probably it was the worst choice that Pakistan Army ever made. But up I went. According to a friend of mine, I did two silly things. Because I was substantive captain, I went up with my captain's badges on to put up Lieutenant Colonel ones the day after I arrived, which was technically correct. But of course the Pakistani majors, temporary majors in that, in the battalion, they, well, what's this captain coming up to become Lieutenant Colonel, even though I had more years of service than they did. I was told that was a silly thing, I should have put the Colonel's ones on before arrival. The second thing was, I remembered living in messes where colonels lived in, and you always felt all colonels there, it was all around. So I said, right, I won't live in the mess, not because I'm British or anything like that, but so you can be completely free and I'll live in the hotel nearby. I think that was a mistake. I should have lived in the mess. It would have been better. I mean, I needn't have gone to the mess an awful lot, but I should have done it. Anyhow, I stayed up there. The second in command, Dosh Muhammad, he had hoped to get command himself, and he disliked me intensely because I'd come in and taken what he thought was his right, and it was made a bit obvious, a bit clear. And in the end, I felt I had to go and say something to the brigadier, look, we can't go on like this. So Dosh Muhammad was posted away to a staff job, didn't lose rank or anything like that, and probably got staff pay. And I carried on, but I began to realize that I know nothing about a fighting unit at all. We were right on the frontier of Jammu, where the Pathans were being pushed through in that first thing.